good.
If we could get, see, the Interlinear, Volume 1 again, the Analytical Hebrew Lexicon, and Englishman's Hebrew Concordance. So all three of those. And then you might want to pull out those two assignments here and keep those handy.
Yeah.
What's that? Yeah, that one. Volume 1 of the Interlinear, and then Englishman's Hebrew Concordance up there by James. Yes, you want to look at the roll book when it comes around and make sure that every class that's not made up, mark it down so you can make it up. And make sure that every assignment, every file is handed in. I should have a total of 4 of them. 2 today, and then 2 others that you've handed in. Okay. So everyone has all 3 books. You need the analytical? You don't have the analytical? James, could you grab one more analytical there? Either you or Ashley? Okay. You're welcome. Now, what we want to do is look up a couple more words here just to kind of get the hang of this. Realistically, you're not going to be able to do near as much in the Old Testament as you can in the New. There are so many more reference books written for the New Testament. Vincent's Word Studies, A.T. Robertson, and Kenneth Wiest, and Vine's Expository Dictionary. And there are so many more word studies and so many more reference tools. And so, realistically, if you can learn to look up a Hebrew word from the Hebrew text, look it up in the analytical, look it up in Englishman's, and therefore look it up in the Hebrew lexicons, that's really quite a bit, if you can learn to do that. So, let's look at a couple more words here. For example, Genesis chapter 17, verse 1. Let's say we want to look up this word here. So we're reading along in chapter 17 and verse 1, it says, "And when Abram was 99 years old, Jehovah appeared to him and said to him, I am the Almighty God, walk before me and be perfect." So God is telling Abraham now, Abraham, you walk before me and be perfect. Now let's say we're interested in the word perfect. So we want to look up the word perfect. in verse 1 of Genesis chapter 17. Now, the first thing that you'd want to do, you want to write down the word from the Greek, from the Hebrew text here. So it's the Hebrew word thamim. That's the word. So you write the word down. Let's look it up in the analytical, first of all. So, the way you look it up, start with the tau, and go to the mem, then the yod, and then a final name, thamim. So you start on the right-hand side with the tau. Hopefully you can find it by the time snow flies. Anyone want to venture a guess? Okay. 500.
Okay.
Yeah.
500 and C is
100. 100. 520
L is 50.
L is 50. 763 is it? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
763. So DCC would be 700, L would be 50, and X would be 10. So 763. So we're looking at, here's the Roman numeral. It's harder to find the Roman numerals than the Hebrew. That one right there. You can help each other. And we're looking in what? The right or left-hand column?
Right page, left-hand column.
Okay. And we're about halfway down. Now, the only difference between this word and the text, this has a little dog-ish in the tau. And that might confuse you and throw you off. That's called a dog-ish. And... which just means that they've included that in the analytical. The same word may occur somewhere else in the Bible with a dogish in it. But don't let that throw you off. This dot in the initial letter is not going to affect the word at all. It's the same exact word. It just affects the pronunciation of it. Instead of thamim, it's now tamim.
Well, there's one up above. Oh, yeah, I see that. What does it mean now?
It just simply, the dot?
Yeah.
Okay, what the dot means, it means that that's a hard T sound. It's a tau, so tamim instead of thamim. Now, you can see that, everyone see where that word is? Go ahead, help your friend there, help your neighbor find it if they haven't found it yet. You'll notice that the word right below it is exactly the same except for a vowel point. You have to look real careful. The first vowel point is a comments versus a pothok. In other words, the one right below it, the only difference, it looks like this. It just has one little mark like that. That's called a pothok. So you have to look at the vowel points real carefully. Now, it gives you the root word. So first of all, we're looking at thamim. It's an adjective. It's masculine. It's singular. Okay? Third declension. And then it gives you the root form. Here's the root form. Like that. So what you want to do, you want to look up this word now, next. So look that up. And do you find that? Okay, it's right on the other side. So you notice it on the other side there. And there on the other side, it defines this word for you. So what did God mean when God told Abraham, walk before me and be perfect? Did God mean absolute, total, sinless perfection in which Abraham could never err? And Abraham, you know, Abraham, I don't want you ever to sin, not once. Or did God have something else in mind? Well, look at the definitions here. It means, first of all, to be completed or ended. It's translated to complete or finish. It means, secondly, to be complete or whole. Thirdly, to be perfect or upright. Or fourthly, to be ended or come to an end. Fifthly, to be consumed, exhausted, or spent. And then so forth. It goes on and talks about this. But and then look down at, towards the bottom of the little article there. It gives you the adjective, the very word we're looking at, down at the very bottom. And it means to be complete or perfect or whole and entire or sound or without blemish or defect. So the idea that God was saying is, Abraham, walk before me and be complete or whole. And when you begin to put it all together, God was saying, Abraham, give me all your heart. You know, lay your whole entire life down before me. That's what I think we're going to begin to see. Let's look in the Englishman's now, Hebrew Chaldee Concordance. Let's look and see how the word is used. Now, probably the easiest way for you to find this word in this is to look back in the English index. Look back in the English index under the word perfect. That'll be quicker. Oh, you've got the Greek. Okay. How many have Greek? Okay. Raise your hands. So you have Greek too? Are you sure that's Greek, Bruce? Is it?
It says English and Greek
concordance. Okay, you've got Greek too.
Really?
Yeah, they got to give you a
little bit. You've only got four, I guess. What happened? What, where did the others go? Are there some Hebrews up there? Yeah, now what you want to do. So everyone that has a Hebrew concordance, look up the word perfect in the English index here, first of all. And we're actually on page 1598 of our concordance here. See, and now because you know the Hebrew word, you can locate it on the proper page number. So what page number do we turn to?
1350.
Okay, 1350. So let's turn to 1350. There's your word, thamim, on page 1350. And notice now, you can begin to look through the list and you can begin to see how this word is really used. Now, for example, it's used in Genesis 6:9, Noah was a just man and perfect or upright. Now, if you read the rest of the verse, it would say, in his generation. So we're talking about a relative perfection, all things being considered. Noah, to the best of his light, to the best of his ability, had yielded his whole life to God. We're talking about a heart commitment here. For example, Exodus 12:5, it's used of the lamb without blemish. And all throughout the book of Leviticus, it's used of the offerings being offered to Yahweh without blemish. And then you can also read, for example, you know, 1 Samuel 14:41, David praying, Lord God of Israel, give me a perfect heart, and so forth. And you can gain a better idea of what the word perfect here means as you begin to examine all these verses here. It has the idea of committing yourself entirely unto God with a total desire for holiness, total commitment to God. Okay? Now, let's look at another example. Let's do this again. Let's look at Genesis chapter 32, verse 25. I'm sorry, Bruce, you had a question.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Look at Genesis 32, verse 25. Incidentally, that would be a very beautiful Bible study, that last truth there on the perfect heart, to go through and to study that. And I think, see, God is not a tyrant demanding absolute perfection of creatures that cannot perform that way, but he is demanding total surrender. With that we can do. That we can do. And as we do that, we become that whole burnt offering for God, and God's love is able to transform us and therefore bring about an experiential perfection. Genesis chapter 32, verse 25. This is the account of Jacob wrestling with the angel of the Lord. And it says in chapter 32, verse 25, and he saw that he had not prevailed against him, and he struck on his hip socket. I'm reading in the margin now. And Jacob's hip socket was unhinged as he wrestled with him. We want to look at the word wrestled here. Well, I need verse 25. I'm sorry, I was up there and I guess I kind of got mixed up in the interlinear here. But down at the bottom of the page is the interlinear, and it says, what was to him and was left Jacob alone and wrestled? You see that at the bottom of the page there? So what we want to do is write down that Hebrew word on the board here for you. Yayavek would be the Hebrew. Okay, that's the Hebrew word that we want to look up right there. Now, what do you know that you do right off the bat? Okay. Okay. So, whenever you have a word that starts with a wow, scratch the letter well and start with the next letter, yod. So, you look up yod, aleph, bet, kof. So, start with yod right here and look that up in the analytical. Now remember, if you're not interested in the grammatical information, the quickest way to find the Hebrew root word would be to go to Strong's or Young's and get the root word there. This is not the quickest way, but it's good practice.
Thank you.
Okay. I would say, is what it is here.
Sorry.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right. Just be glad your calculator isn't set up on Roman numerals. Is it on 7 or 8? Huh? Okay, there it is. What do you know? Huh? 287. CCLXXXVII. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead and help your friend there if they can't find it. And the description there, can anyone venture a guess on the description of the verb there? Yeah. Nifal, future, third person singular, masculine. Nifal. Now, you know, again, this is going to be probably beyond your scope of knowledge unless you've studied this, but it's a nifal future third person singular masculine, and the nifil or nifal is a passive form of the Hebrew verb. So what it means is when this angel was wrestling with Jacob, it means he was being wrestled upon. So it's not like he had a choice and the option. This angel pounced on him and was wrestling him and eventually knocked his thigh out of place. And I mean, he was battling for his life. He was struggling for his life. This was an angelic spiritual struggle. Now, notice the root form there is avak. So, it gives you the root form. And let's turn there in the analytical and look that one up. Avak. So, aleph, beth, kof. So we're going to be at the very front now with the aleph and the beth. Yes. Now, actually, this one has vowel points on it. Here. Which is fine, which is no problem. But really, this is the one you're looking at, right there. So it has the vowel points. Don't let the vowel points throw you. The main ones, the main thing that you need to look at to start with are the consonants. So we're on Roman numeral page 5. Roman numeral page 5. Aleph, Beth, Kof. Yeah, to dust each other. And it means to wrestle or to dust each other by wrestling. So what was happening, they were wrestling and the dust was flying. And this angel was prevailing upon Jacob, and if someone was trying to knock your thigh out of joint, you'd probably wrestle back too. And I'm not sure if this angel had a full Nelson on Jacob or what was going on. But anyway, the dust was just a-flying. Okay, now let's look up our word in the Englishman's Hebrew Concordance. So we want to look in the English index first under wrestle. Page 1680. On page 1680. Okay. There it says to wrestle, and we want page 13. So we turn back to page 13. And there's the word right there, havak. And it is related to the Hebrew word dust, the word right above it. Only difference is one vowel point. Don't let the fact that it's spelled like this in the analytical and it's spelled like this in the Hebrew concordance, there's a difference, it has only one line like that. Don't be unduly concerned about the vowel points. As long you can tell just by the scripture verses that you have the right word here. That's your check. That may confuse you, but they included the reference back in the analytical. It gave you Genesis chapter 32 and told you what it meant. And now let's look up one more, just again, to just give you the opportunity of getting the feel of how to do this. Let's say, for example, you're reading along in Genesis chapter 49 and verse 10 now. Genesis 49 verse 10. It says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come, and the gathering of the people shall be to him." In verse 10. So we're interested in this word scepter, Hebrew word scepter there in verse 10. And we're looking at spelling of a word that looks like this. That up in the analytical. What's that?
Well, if you use this quite a bit, you'd probably get pretty fast.
You'd be surprised how fast you can get. You can go pretty fast. So it's the Hebrew word shevet.
It's on page 500.
Yeah. Okay, so we're looking at 697, is it? 697? So
here's the Roman numeral. That's the one you want right there.
DCXCVII.
What's the difference between either one of the? This one has
double. That is actually an accent mark.
Or it's called, there's a name for it. I forget what the name of it is. It
starts with an M. Mm-hmm.
But that little slash that you see there, is that it? Mm-hmm. Are you thinking?
Yeah, that's a little.
It's not actually a vowel point, but it's. Don't worry about it. It's.
Yes. Sometimes what happens is the nouns and the verbs are listed according to a certain form. Like the nouns are listed according to the first person singular masculine declension, and that's what this happens to be. So there it is right there. It means a staff or a rod for punishment and so forth, or a scepter, spear, or a lance. So the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come. Now let's look it up in Englishments. So look up scepter in the English index. Okay, 1625. Okay, 1225 is where it's actually located. Turn over to 1225. There it is, right there. Sometimes you'll notice, particularly with Hebrew, much more so than Greek, that there are words that are translated differently in the English that appear to have no connection. Like here, scepter talks about a staff that you rule with, but it's also connected to the Hebrew word tribe. And that's not uncommon in the Hebrew to have one Hebrew word that can mean almost two different things with no apparent connection. It might come from, if you traced it way back, there might be some connection, like with each tribe, see, there was a standard or a scepter that marked that tribe. They had a certain banner that they carried in front of them, and it might be linked to that, some type of idea, like a family banner. Okay, let's pass these back. Put these back on the shelf, and let's look at our assignments here. Let's put all the Hebrew ones now on the right-hand side, the Hebrew concordance. Just you know, scholars are like that sometimes. They just, some guy, he probably spent They were so versed during that time, back in the 1850s, and they were so knowledgeable, that was probably just common nature. I mean, they have no problem whatsoever with Roman numerals. But it's really obsolete nowadays, obviously. That's just like if you read all the older commentators, like Adam Clark and Lang's commentary, and they have these Latin phrases in them. They'll quote Latin. Why? I mean, with no translation. But during that time, it was a common thing of scholastic ability to be able to read Latin. Everyone during that time. In all the American schools, they taught Latin. No, when I went to high school, Latin was a fairly big class that they taught. I doubt if they even teach it anymore. I don't know. Maybe they do. Yeah, if you're going to study medicine. But during that time, that was just standard. In fact, in a lot of American schools, the kids were taught Greek as well as Latin. Oh, yeah, they studied Greek. More from a literary standpoint, huh?
The Catholic Church, how large that was, that's what they had their Mass
for. Latin?
Latin.
Right. Okay, let's look at our assignments here real quick. So pull these out. File number 35, first of all. I'll read the answers to you. If you have any problems, feel free to ask me about it. It says in part 1, Matthew 5:41 in the King James Version, look it up. Okay. Talks about whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Number 2, look up compel in Young's and give the Greek word. It's angaruo, which means to impress as on public service. Number 3, examine Vincent's for this passage. What truth is shown by the use of the word? He said that the word pertains to oppressing in a service legally by a duly appointed officer. Okay, number 4. What further information does Vines add to your understanding? He says it means to dispatch as an angaros, who is a Persian courier kept at regular stages with power of impressing men in a service, used to the impressing of Simon to bear Christ's cross. Number 5, what does Strong's Concordance give? To be a courier or to press in a public service. Number 6, does this shed light on the verse? Yes. Number 7, describe the meaning of the verse in the light of this information. Well, your answer is going to vary from mine a little bit, but the main truth that is seen in this verse, I think, is this. If you are commanded by someone with legal authority to do something, you are to obey not grudgingly or with a rebellious heart, but willingly as a testimony to the gospel. The heart that is really talked about here is not whether you actually go 1 mile or two, but it's talking about the willingness to obey legal authority over you in an unpleasant task or something that you may feel that it's inconvenient for you to do. Now, this does not apply to non-legal harassment or any commandment, of course, contrary to the Bible. In other words, when Jesus said, "Whosoever should compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain," it was a common custom in Palestine for the Romans to come up, and the Romans had political power over the Jews, and come up and tell some Jew, "Carry this bag of letters over to Caesarea there. They're maybe a mile outside of town." And they were under Roman law obligated because the Romans had authority over them. And Jesus said, when they ask you to do that, take it 2 miles. And then when they ask you, "Boy, you're a nice guy. I mean, how come you're so nice?" Share with them the gospel. It will open up a door. It'll be different than the attitude of some of the other Jews that scowled and spit along the whole way and stomped on the letters when the Roman wasn't looking and everything, you know? Spit in his cup of tea when he was looking the other way or whatever. I mean, it demonstrated a different attitude to the Romans. And so this is not talking about some guy that comes up on the street, 2nd Avenue in Seattle, and says, "Yeah, give me a ride to the airport," or whatever. Now you got to give him a ride to the airport to obey the scripture that Jesus said. Not talking about anything like that. It'd be comparable, for example, they have a law in the forest with the Forest Service, that if you're out there in the Forest Service and a fire starts and you happen to be in the vicinity and you're an able-bodied man, they can actually enlist you to fight that fire, to dig trenches legally, according to the American government. They've even got signs up there. And that's just common knowledge if you live in certain parts of Idaho and Montana. And they have the right to do that, and you would do it cheerfully, see, in that instance. So the main point that you probably should have seen in that is that this is talking about someone with legal authority, impressing you into service. Then part two, any questions on the first one? Yes.
What if they have the power? In other words, if they, you know, those who have the guns rule.
You mean if more you live in a country like Russia?
Yeah, more of a tyrant, you know.
You're obligated to obey as long as it doesn't contradict your conscience and go against the Bible. You unfortunately live under that rulership. They may do it at gunpoint or at spear point. What can you do? I mean, you have to manifest a submissive attitude, and it may be unreasonable. See, Jesus didn't say to do this only if it's reasonable to what fits in with your time schedule.
What if they're violating the constitution of the land, let's say?
Well, see, that, you know, of course, in Russia now, their constitution to us would be illegal, I suppose, but to them in that country, that's the country they're under. And so, well, yeah, you can't go against biblical morality in your conscience, but, so you have to be careful that we don't adopt an attitude, well, bless God, I mean, this is an ungodly government, and I don't have to do anything they want. Or I don't have to do a lot of things that they want me to do. Because...
Yeah, we're not... Let's see.
If they took over America?
Well, no, let's just say that America's already taken over.
Okay.
And that we're living under a law of men rather than a land of law, you know, which mm-hmm. we're under a constitution mm-hmm. of the United mm-hmm. States. Mm-hmm. And let's just say that the local governments are in violation of your constitutional rights. Let's just say that they're just doing it for extracting money out of Joe Blow Public, and they're just, making $40 a minute in these traffic courts and this and that, and but they're in actuality violating, you know, the higher law, you know, and
well, you can't.
It's a contradiction. No. You have rights, but those rights don't count. Because they've got it set up to where it's a money-making machine, and they've got all these laws and everything that they have written that more or less block, you know, your rights mm-hmm. out of the picture. And unless you go through a big, long court battle, you're not going to be able to...
I guess, sir, this is a real complicated... You know, we have to get into a whole class on morality and ethics. For something like that. There are a lot of things that happen even in America that aren't really just, and at one time we're not being carried taxes at one time for many years. People are shocked to find out we didn't have taxes in America. Not right. You know, taxes on your wages on a yearly basis like what we have now. That started back with the wars, and then it became a permanent thing to float the government. So there's a number of things that are being done now, but you know, there are still recognized governmental institutions that say we want your tax money, and as long as the government recognizes that institution, whether I feel like it's just or not, I'm still obligated to give them that tax money. And there are Christians that they take a firmer stand. They say, nope, I mean, it's going for things that I don't agree with, it's unjust, wasn't part of the original constitution, I won't pay my taxes. But really what that is manifesting is an attitude of unsubmission. Because they're not being asked to go against their conscience. See, I mean, they're being asked... Paul told the Romans to render taxes to whom taxes were due. And they had to give taxes to the Roman government. Now, that government was corrupt to the hilt. And what they used that money for, they had 159 official holidays every year in which people were killed by the scores in those gladiator fights, all at government expense, all with tax monies being used for that type of thing. And Paul said, pay it. Now, if it comes to a point where they say, don't pray, don't read your word, don't witness, don't go to church, don't send your child to Christian school, you know, you quit teaching these classes, quit teaching the Bible in your Christian school, that's all an entirely different ballgame, man. But Jesus just basically saying that someone with legal authority here, if they ask you to do something, do it, and do even beyond what they ask you.
So if the court decides, you know, like there's a separation of church and state, for example, mm-hmm. then you know that that's going to lead to an ostracizing of the church, you know, to be seen in public. You know, because we're all wards of the state. In other words, they mm-hmm. redefine everything.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. We didn't intend getting into that with file 35, but you could probably ask Chuck Moore in the lawyer or something in our church.
But I need to move on here, really. I don't know. Those are good questions, but they're deep. I've thought a lot about those points. Where do you draw the line? I don't know. Part 2, John 6:31. What is the Greek word for bread? It's artone. Number 2, look up bread and Strong's. Find the Greek word. Number 740, artos. What is the difference? Number 3, difference between a nu and a sigma. Okay. Number 4, look up the word, John 6:31. In the analytical, find the dictionary spelling and so forth. Number 5, what is the reason for the alternate spelling? Well, it says artone is the accusative form of artos. That's the difference. So, in other words, artos is the root form, and artone is the accusative form. It's the direct object of the sentence.
I couldn't find that.
In other words, you couldn't find artone?
Artone was nominative singular, is that correct?
Right.
That's all I...
No, artos should
artos,
be.
Artos, right.
It's a nominative singular. But artone was not in there? How many of you did find it in there?
Did
find it. Artone.
You had to go back to the remark 3 something or other, if I remember correctly.
Because I don't remember any problems with this. And I'm just wondering if you...
Back to the front of the book, I think.
I saw a note that said some nouns of this declension are contracted in all cases when preceded by an E, O, U, and an O. That was a note.
I'm just wondering if maybe you're not looking at a different word here, because I haven't found any problems with this before. So I'm wondering, and I think for lack of time, I think I'll just move on. If some of you found it, then it's in there. I think I found it without any problem, so it's in there. Okay, part 3, look up James 2:9. Number 2, look up this verse in the Kingdom Interlinear, find the Greek word for respect of persons. Prosopolempteta. Locate this word in the analytical Greek lexicon. Notice a slight difference in spelling. What does Vine's dictionary give as the reason? It's missing the letter mu in inferior texts. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How's the word grammatically related to its dictionary form? It's the second person plural present indicative of prosopolepteo. Got that? You don't?
Say it again.
It is the second person plural present indicative. So, in other words, it says that it's second person plural present indicative of prosopolepteo. Well, number 4, for lack of time, look up the definition of this verb in the analytical. What is it? To accept or respect the person of anyone, or to pay regard to external appearance and so forth. Number 5, the analytical lists two other nouns that are directly related to this verb. What are those two nouns? Prosopoleptes, a respecter of persons, and prosopolepsia, respect or partiality. I don't know if you got those two.
I got one that said the face of the countenance. It was...
Prosopone? Okay, that's number 6. What information is found on a related word in Vincent's Greek word studies? See on verse 1, it's from prosopone, the countenance, and lambano, to receive. To receive the countenance is a Hebrew phrase.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Let me give you the answers for the next one, the next file here. I'm not sure if you got all that last, all the points on that, but I want to get to file 36 because it has some important things here. Number 1, Strong's Concordance, find the Greek word for born. It's 1080 ganao. Number 2, the Greek word for again is 509 anothen. What is the meaning of this word according to Strong from above? How many times is it found according to Englishman's Greek Concordance? 13. Number 3, according to the analytical, what is the voice of the verb for born? What is it? It's passive. Okay, passive. Number 4, in a brief sentence, how do Dana and Manny define this particular voice? The subject receives the action, page 161. Number 5, according to Strong's, what is the Greek word for born again in 1 Peter 1:23? Anaganao, which means to beget. Use Strong's number system to describe the roots of this verb. It comes from ana, 303, properly meaning up, often has the idea of repetition, and then ganao, 1080, to procreate, figuratively to regenerate. Number 6, look up the Greek word in Englishman's. What other New Testament reference uses the word? 1 Peter 1:13,
which has begotten us again unto a lively hope. 1:3, I'm sorry. Number 7, use the interlinear along with the analytical Greek lexicon. Find the grammatical analysis of this word as it appears in these two verses. Then write the scripture reference and so forth. Well, chapter 1, verse 3, it's a nominative singular masculine participle, aorist, one, active. And then in chapter 1, verse 23, it's a nominative plural masculine participle, perfect, passive. Number 8, let me get the answers here on the tape real quick. Why do you think the voice of the verb form is different in these two passages? Well, verse 3, God is the subject and shows him performing the action. We've been born again by God. See, it's God that has performed the action. Verse 23, the saints are the implied subject. Therefore, it's a passive voice showing that we receive the action. We are the recipients of this born-again experience. Number 9, the verbs in both of these passages are a particular kind of verb form. What is that form? Participle. They're a participle. Number 10, read Dan and Manti, section 202. Okay, what does he say about it? It's antecedent action relative to the main verb, which is ordinarily expressed by the aorist or perfect. In other words, if you have an aorist or perfect participle, the action of the participle has taken place before the action of the main verb of the sentence. How is this participle translated in the Greek in the interlinear, having been generated again? Then it says 11, some cults teach that being born again is an experience which occurs after this life, not during it. Light of the tense of the participle in chapter 1, verse 23. Can you refute any information along that line? Yes. The main verb is love one another in verse 22. The participle is being born again. So the participle is in the perfect tense, showing it's an action that occurred prior to us loving one another. In other words, the commandment to love one another is predicated on a new birth which has already happened. So what you may have gotten is just the fact that the new birth has already happened. It's a perfect tense. So it's really saying that our love for one another is based on the fact that we've been born again. It's already occurred. Peter is therefore addressing those who have been already born again, not something that's going to happen after they die. 1 Peter 1:3 confirms this. It's an aorist participle. It says we have been begotten again. So it's already occurred. Now, are there any questions on these two? Anything that you cannot see, you have a problem with? Let me just tell you about three reference works here in 2 minutes. This one, you know, it's called Aaron Picks. It's you can look up any word that's in the King James Bible. It'll give you the English word and a couple Hebrew words underneath that translated that way, with references where the word is found. The definitions are very, very short. It's really, in my opinion, a duplication of Young's, and it's not worth the money to buy, to be honest with you. If you already bought it, you blew about $10, just like I did. If you haven't bought one and you want to buy one, call me up and I'll sell you one. There's another one here. This is by W.E. Vine. It's his work on the Old Testament. It's not near as complete as the New Testament, as you can see by how slender it is. And it has a couple of choice words from the Old Testament. What is in here is real good. And, you know, I don't know, it's probably about $10. I don't know if it's worth the money, though, to buy. But there are words in here, real key ones, theologically, that are good. Now, there's another book that you can purchase called Wilson's Old Testament Word Studies. And this is a really good work. And it's very similar to Aaron Picks, but the definitions are much fuller. You look up the word from the King James, and he'll give you the list of the Hebrew words with the scriptures that they're found in. And the definitions are really good. They're much fuller, and they're not technical. It's very easy for you to use. You can pull it down off the shelf, look it up. You don't need to know any Hebrew, and you have a good definition there. The next one, if you want a more technical definition, you use something like Gesenius's, and that's the light blue volume back there. Gesenius's is the Thayer's of the Old Testament. It's more technical. It's more stilted, more literal. But it's much harder to find the word in that unless you purchase new Gesenius's, which is key to Strong's. Which, if you're going to get one and you're not, you know, going to learn the Hebrew language, you know, get the new Gesenius's, which is key to Strong's, which will save you a lot of time trying to find the word. There's also another one called Brown, Drivers, and Briggs, which is also key to Strong's, which would be another good reference tool, but it's a little bit more liberal than Gesenius's. Okay, you can pass in your assignments. No, you can just... Yeah, let's pass them in separately. That'd be easier for me. What's that?
Do you want to separate them?
Oh, that's all right. That's all right if they're not. That's all right. That's all right.
You know, as far as that, the laws, you know.
Can someone put these back in the Hebrew section for me of the library?
Like, which is, you know what that is?
Yes. Like, Pastor, if the law, you know, like on the tele, the law said that the president went higher up over their head.
Yeah, yeah, you have that right.
That's possible. I mean, that's not disobeying that. It's,
oh, no, no.
It's like I found out building my house, you have some laws that, you know, make it really straight.
Yeah, you can do that. There's nothing wrong with that.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
Well, like,
you have to figure out where to really draw the line and how petty to be. And
oh, you're welcome, Jim.
You know.
I left one of those home. I grabbed one. You already corrected. So what do I do?
Okay.
Sit
just
with my notebook. Do it.
Just throw it in my box. No problem.
Okay.
This year was last week when you finished correcting and I haven't turned in.
Sure.
I wasn't.
Okay.